Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon. I am thinking of initiating a series, and if this goes well, I will make this the first one in it. There are lots of people in the world who are Latter-day Saints and have very, very interesting perspectives. And one of the places that interesting perspectives comes from is when you are fully immersed or really largely to a great degree immersed in some other philosophical system, religious tradition, you know, some kind of school of thought or something like that. And it allows you to kind of have, you know, ideas that come from this other place. We've got all these ideas that come from Mormonism, and we put them together and they come into this really nice creative tension with each other where, you know, insights can spring up and things like this. And so I want to do a series where I invite people who associate with another religion in their past or through their philosophical study or their own, spiritual supplementing. I actually did a podcast about a year ago, and one of our guests who's on this one tonight was on that one. We talk about with Mormons who sort of double dip or, you know, do more than things just for Mormonism that kind of feed their lives. So I want to do a series, and to initiate this and to kick it off, I have four people who are on this podcast who are all Mormons, committed Mormons, who are also very active Freemasons. And so we're going to have a discussion about Mormonism and Masonry, but unlike a typical thing where it's all like, oh, how much of Masonry did Mormonism borrow for the temple ceremony and things like this, we're just going to let other podcasts that have gone into great detail be the place for you to look for those. And I'll hit these guys up and they'll send me some links of where they think it's been well discussed or something like that. But this one is going to be autobiographical. This is going to be four guys telling us about their journey to Masonry, some of the ideas in Masonry that kind of captivate their mind and make Mormon stuff richer or take it in new angles that they find to be fruitful and maybe they've shared with others. And then also the social fraternal aspect of Masonry and how that impacts their life and how that actually makes them maybe see some things in Mormonism differently. So that is our plan. And let me introduce the ringleader or have him introduce himself. Patrick McCleary, you're the guy who was on the podcast before. Welcome back to Mormon Matters. And you were the person who really took the point on getting this great group of guys together. So would you start with an introduction of yourself?
Yeah, sure, Dan. It's good to be doing another podcast with you. As you mentioned, I was on the previous podcast on a similar topic, so I'll keep it brief. But my name's Patrick McCleary, and I live north of Salt Lake City. I am a lifelong member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and I've been a Freemason since 2008. And since I was raised to a Master Mason, I have later joined both Scottish Rites and York Rite. Scottish Rite and York Rite Freemasonry. And one of my proudest moments of Masonry is getting to know these other three gentlemen here. So without further ado, I'll just turn it back to you, cool. Dan.
And we may or may not go into what Scottish Rite and York Rite are. Again, sure. The level of detail we'll hear will mostly be autobiographical. But as you share, for instance, in this section where we talk about ideological stuff, maybe some of that will come up as to what those emphases are or something. So, okay. But thank you so much, my friend. Long Tibbetts, you and I and Patrick got together maybe 8 or 9 months ago and had a great lunch. I'm really excited that you decided to join us. Would you tell us a little bit about the story of what you do for, you know, where you live, all that good stuff, and we'll do later about how you became involved with Masonry.
You bet. So Lon Tibbetts, some know me as Lorenzo Tibbetts, and I am a lifelong member of the church. My folks both come from pioneer stock in Utah. I didn't, I like to say, because I was a military brat, so grew up outside of the state of Utah. Came here only because Dad retired while I was on a mission and came back home, but then married locally, and so I've been local for the rest of that time since then. Served in a variety of positions in the church, including bishop and high counselor, and joined Masonry in 2006. I'll tell you later on, that was my second attempt. The first one was before the ban in Utah was lifted.
Oh, yeah.
Among Masons, and that didn't work out well. Since joining in 2006, I've also joined the Scottish Rite, the New York Rite, and am also a fairly active member of the AMD, or Allied Masonic Degrees, and very much enjoy my relationship with my lodge, with Scottish Rite, and currently serve. I'm in my third year as a Grand Lodge officer in the Grand Lodge of Utah, and enjoy very much traveling the state and meeting Masons throughout the state.
Very cool. Thank you so much. We can't wait to hear more. Joe Swick, tell us about yourself, brother.
Yes, I am. I'm not a lifelong member of the church. I first joined the church in 1977, and first engaged Freemasonry after my return from my mission to Japan in 1982. So I've not lived in Utah for a long time. I lived there for several years, but live in Washington State and have worked at a local software company up here in Redmond.
So. Local as in like the local global one? Or
yeah. That one. That's the one.
The big one up there in Washington.
Right. So this is where I've kind of spent most of my time, but have spent some years in Utah. And in fact, when I became a Freemason, I did that in Utah as well. I actually joined a lodge in Utah. I was the first Latter-day Saint. Solon, you'll appreciate this. I was the first Latter-day Saint in my lodge. Joined in 1980. Oh, excuse me. I'm padding that. It was 1994, and was raised early in 1995. Even though the ban or the restriction had been lifted for some time, it took a while for that to kind of propagate through the system there, as I'm sure you're aware.
Yes, Joe, it certainly did. Which lodge?
Story Lodge number 4.
Story.
I'm still a member of Story Lodge. Story in Damascus meet right on the hill there between Provo and Orem. The building is right there, and if anybody hearing this podcast happens to be local to that, I highly recommend that you go and knock on the door and talk to somebody there. It's a good place to be.
Cool. Thanks so much, Joe. Appreciate having you. George Miller, another out-of-stater here joining us. Welcome to the podcast. Could you tell us about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for having me. So, like several people here, I'm a lifelong Mormon. Largely, although I was born in Utah, grew up in the Kansas area. Like Joe, I served my mission in Japan. And then eventually found my way to Nashville, Tennessee, where I attended Vanderbilt and got my PhD. While there, I became it had been a long interest, but finally became a Freemason, was raised to the sublime degree of Master Mason. After that, moved up to Michigan, where I currently am living, where I did a postdoctoral fellowship. And while there, I was very, very blessed to serve as the worshipful master of Ann Arbor Fraternity Lodge number 262. Like these other brethren, I am a Scottish Rite Mason, belong to the Scottish Rite Research Society, and have been very interested in the Mormon Masonic research. Gave a presentation a couple of years ago at the MHA on the subject, as well as have done a series of podcasts for the Mormon Expressions podcast on the Mormon Masonic connection.
Yes.
And most recently did a very short podcast on the connections between Freemasonry and the Relief Society for the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast. So that's kind of my pedigree there as far as the Mormon history angle.
Cool. Thanks so much for being on. I can't wait to hear more from you. All right, guys. So this podcast is, again, the first of this experimental possible series of, you know, things that have enriched your Mormonism, your life, when you're in dialogue with two different traditions. So what I'd like to have each of you do is just a little bit more detail now, just a few minutes each. Tell the story of, like, hey, man, I'm cruising along as a Mormon, and then all of a sudden this Masonry became attractive to me, something brought me to it, and, you know, what started to intrigue you to where you guys would join, and then it looks like most of you have gone on to Scottish Rite or York Rite or Lawn, in your case, to move into Grand Lodge kind of leadership and things like this. So I kind of want to hear your story of Mormonism to Masonry, and then one piece I want you to address, if you had this tension at all, is like, did this like sit in your heart in a weird way, like, is this all right to do? Am I violating some kind of thing by saying Mormonism, I don't know if you phrased it in your own brain, it's not enough for me the way I'm getting it, or there's something missing in my spiritual life or something, is that why you did it? But I kind of want to know if there were tensions that were sort of internal to you. So, Patrick, can we just kind of go in the same order and just have you lead out a little bit with that kind of part of your journey?
Okay, so my story takes place in late 2007 during Christmas break. I usually save up my vacation from work, take a couple weeks off around Christmas. And as the trend was at that time, there were a lot of Masonic documentaries on the History Channel and Discovery Channel and things of that nature. And I had seen them all before. And one night I was watching one, and as I tell the story to other people, I tell them I'm grateful for this because I never really had a conversion story the way others had when they joined the church, but this is my conversion story to something else. So
nice.
It just felt like a bomb went off in my head. I have no idea. I had felt what we call the spirit before and other things, but this was unrelated to Mormonism in many respects. So it felt like a bomb went off in my head, and I had to join Masonry. And so I upset my wife quite a bit during this break because I was up all day and all night studying Masonry and then its connections to Mormonism, kind of in the background of that. The reason why I felt so compelled to join initially was because I think men need to learn how to become men. Looking at the roots of Masonry, it's always been around to teach men how to be gentlemen. And maybe I was waxing philosophical then and am a bit now, but I at that time I was thinking a lot about how we had a lot of boys who were entering the ages where they should be men. And I wanted to, if Masonry was a stepping stone from the past of defenders of virtue, morality, any kind of disciplinary morality system, I thought, well, I'm going to join this. I'm going to keep this alive. And then you asked about if I had any hang-ups about joining. Because of Mormonism, yeah. So I started understanding more and more about the connections with Mormonism. As I said, more on a superficial level. We can get more in-depth as far as the connections later if you want. But this is another thing that I really owe a lot to Masonry to as well, because I had a testimony of Joseph Smith. I've always had a deep testimony of my beliefs in the church. But when I looked at the connections with Joseph and Masonry, I had a continual prayer in my heart, and I was seeking for wisdom as to what Joseph, if he took anything from Masonry, what did he take, and is Joseph a prophet? And as I usually receive inspiration from the Spirit, it just hit me one night, clear as day, when I was thinking about something else, that Joseph was a prophet, and he didn't steal from Masonry, as it were, but it was more Joseph was a prophet, and God doesn't care if you join Masonry or not. Do what you want to do. And so that cleared up any sort of pangs in my heart about that. And then it's been a great blessing, because being a Mormon and a Mason right now, as Lon and the other two gentlemen here and I have discussed over the years, especially in Utah, because I want to bring back Masonry to Mormons who want to accept it. So it's not open for everybody, Masonry, just like Mormonism, I suppose. But there shouldn't be any sort of wall that keeps people from it. So that's the short long of it.
Nice. No, that's terrific. That gives us a good sense of the kind of especially the spiritual journey to it. Lon, tell us about you, and then, boy, you really have gone crazy with it.
Yeah, I guess so. Having grown up a military brat, one of the things I noticed as a kid, as a teen, as a young adult, if you will, was that it seemed to me like all of the really heroic flyers, all of the best officers, the best NCOs, all wore a ring with a square and compasses on it. So as a kid, I was kind of attracted to it, and I always lived in places that where Mormons were Masons. There were just flyers who were Masons. There were NCOs who were Masons. So I, of course, didn't have the built-in prejudice that a lot of members of the church in Utah have, where for years, for decades, really, Masonry has been kind of the enclave of the anti-Mormon, if you will. And so there's been this misunderstanding that built up, I think, ever since Johnston's army rolled in with a charter from Missouri to open a lodge. And others have not had that opportunity. So I didn't have that, and didn't really pursue anything with that. Served a mission, of course, went to college, served a mission, went to college, the usual pattern, got married. And about 1979, I went in the military myself, did a little bit of active duty and then a lot of reserve duty with the Air Force, and then went to work in manufacturing, which is kind of my background. And one day I was busy talking to a man who was about to become the potentate of the Shriners, and a close colleague, and I think it was the first time I realized he was a Mason. And so the year is 1981-ish, right in that range. And I say to him, hey, I've always been interested. How do I go about becoming a member? And he starts drawing his arm across his shirt, in kind of a semicircle kind of a pattern. And he says, Lon, I'd be glad to sign your petition, but they won't even read it. And I'm looking at my shirt, wondering what's wrong with it. Suddenly realize it's my smiley face with my garments. Yeah. And and so I say to him, but wait, in Southern California, the high counselor that used to come from Barstow and speak to us in Victorville was a Mason. I know, because he had this ring that was about the size of a golf ball. And he said, yeah, any other state in the nation, any other country in the world, but not here. And so we worked together for about a decade. I know, I remember knowing that in 1984, the ban had been dropped. As Joe mentions, it took a while. It took a while before that turned around. And him being the first Mason in a lodge in 1994 is about how long that took for that to start really opening up. Since his timing, of course.
Can I ask just again?
Yes.
I want to keep this autobiographical, but is it because there's a sense of, oh, if we start letting Mormons in, they're going to take over? Or they're going to, all of a sudden we have to become teetotalers? Or what was the hesitation? Or Mormons already have their secret rites, their sacred ceremonies. Why do they need ours? I'd just love to hear a little bit more about the hesitations in Utah.
Well, I'll speak really briefly on that and just say that while I think all of those things had something to do with it, as I read, especially this year, as I'm grand orator this year, so I speak all over the state, and I've done a great deal of research into our history, especially lodge by lodge, and the stated reason was really that even though we dropped polygamy as a church, we were still polygamous in our heart, and therefore our intentions were not to obey the federal law, but to break it, and if we ever had an opportunity, we would go back and do so, having to do with polygamy. So that's really the stated reason anyway. I think there were other motives and other reasons that went along with it. And honestly, Illinois was not our finest hour.
Yeah.
So that's, there's no doubt that there were pieces of that. But so I was actually later on, getting back to the biography, I was actually later on working for the church for about 7 years, and had the opportunity of being the group manager of the Granite Mountain Records Vault. and came home one night. I was also serving as bishop in my ward. We lived across the street from the church. And I came home one night and I said to my wife, "We live in a really strange world today, you and I. We no longer have friends we spend any time with or acquaintances that we do anything with or even neighbors around us," because there were none that fit that category, "who are not members of the church. I'm in a white shirt 6 days a week, sometimes seven. We have become so steeped in our religion at this point, and I just am not sure that this is healthy." And so I'd had this interest in Masonry. I'd kind of put on the back burner, and I don't know what it was that triggered it for me, but at some point there, I thought, you know, the brethren keep telling us to get out in the community and do things with other members of other faiths and other organizations and be involved in our communities and get, you know, not every charity needs to be one that you can write down on your tithing slip. Not everything you do needs to be something that's in the ward house. And so it kind of rekindled my desire to do that. But as you mentioned, Dan, in the back of my mind now, for I think for the first time, it never had occurred to me before, but in the back of my mind was a, you know, I need to find out more about these guys before I just go jumping in. What if they really are the Gadianton robbers, you know, for example? And so yeah. I spent about 4 years reading everything I could get my hands on, some of it really awful. I don't recommend the historical channel to anybody. At this point, if you want history. It was just one of those things that over that four-year period of time, I was looking for how are they organized? Now it's how are we? How are they organized? What is it that they believe? What is it that they do? What makes them important? And more important to me was what makes them relevant in the life of a man. And I think I was beginning to become aware of something that I've become very aware of now, and that is the plight or decline of the male, especially in the United States, and our displacement, I think our confusion, the way we wander around and can't really figure out what our role in society is anymore now that everything has happened the way it's happened. And I kept being struck by why is it that in order for one gender to gain their equality, the other one has got to step back? Why is it that the two of them can't figure out their places together, can't do these things together? You can't denigrate one gender without hurting, you know, half of the population, and that's never a good thing, especially if it's the half that's more violent than the other. So those things kind of all came together, and in 2006, I think I'd investigated enough that I felt comfortable it was the right thing to do. I didn't go check it out with a stake president or a bishop. I'd come in a place in my own personal spirituality where I didn't care. I felt like I was much more informed than they were at that point, and I certainly look back on it now and believe that I'm much more informed on this particular issue than any of them are. So those who have a problem with it, I feel like it's my job to explain, to instruct, to illuminate, to help them to see what it is that's relevant and beautiful and virtuous about this fraternity that I belong to.
Great. Thank you. And we will ask for some of that virtuous, lovely section from you as well. So thanks so much. And now both of you have talked about teaching you how to become men and all that kind of stuff too. So that's another angle that somewhere along the line, I'm going to definitely want to dive a little bit deeper with you guys, because that's pretty fascinating and kind of dangerous territory. I can see some of our listeners not quite getting what's going on there, so we'll have to hit you guys up for it. But let's continue our stories. I think Joe, you're our next person in the lineup if we go in the same order.
My story is a little bit different. I'm a convert to the church, so the background of my family, you know, I was rooted in Freemasonry. Part of my family came from Irish or Scotland, and they immigrated to Canada. But they have a tradition in Freemasonry, and my great-grandfather, when he passed away, it was when I was very young, but I remember my mother talking to me about his funeral in the small local church, and that during his funeral, the entire church was filled by his Masonic brothers. They're dressed in their suits, their gloves, their aprons, and their glittering jewels, and she told me that she had been unaware of how many friends her grandfather had. And how reassuring that had been for her and for the family, right? She felt that their support, that the lodge's support by their attendance at his funeral, was really meaningful for our family. So by the time I was interested in pursuing Masonry, you know, interested in joining the lodge, I didn't have any living relatives, you know, who could recommend me. But I had been to the Grand Lodge of Utah. I was living in Utah at the time. And the Grand Secretary, Lon, you might know him. It was he's passed away, I believe, since then, but it's Bob Brayman. Bob conducted me around, and we had lots of discussions about what that meant and what this meant. And if anybody has not been to the Grand Lodge of Utah, they're building there and they're local, they should take some time to go and see this. It's magnificent. The lodge rooms are open to view, you know, when there's nothing else going on there. And someone will be happy to kind of escort you around to show you the various rooms and to discuss that with you. That was my initial experience. I read Albert Pike, and then I read, this was the moment when I decided that, no, I really was going to pursue this. I talked to, like I said, Bob Brayman, and who's the Grand Secretary. But then I was reading some stuff about Masonry. I read Carl Cloudy's little three-volume introduction to Masonry, and there was this little part in the third volume where, and I'm just going to read this quickly here. It's very short. He said, "How long is a rope? A silly question. It can be answered, presumably, if one can find one end and measure it to the other. Suppose the rope has only one end. Sillier and sillier. But if two ends are true of a rope, are they true of space and time and eternity? If time has a beginning, says Cloudy, it has an ending. If space commences somewhere, there also will be its end to be found. If eternity has a beginning, said Cloudy, it is not eternal." And he said, "Here is the shock, the surprise, and the glory of the third degree. It presents us with eternity in the midst of life. It pushes back the confines of our little dimensions, our tiny measurements of time, our small comprehension of space, and shows us that we enter eternity at neither birth nor death. We have always been in eternity, if we are in it at all." Hiram Abiff, who is the kind of allegorical figure who for early Freemasons represented Jesus Christ, but everybody interprets those things as they will, you know, as they, that's their privilege. But he says the legend of Hiram, that Hiram Abiff was gathered to his fathers when the selfishness and sin of misguided men struck him down, but they were powerless against the paw of the lion, which is a reference to the grip of divine grace. And if you're a Latter-day Saint and you've been endowed, you think about the ceremony of the veil, and this will become really clear to you what it's about, the grip of divine grace. He said he was gathered to his fathers when the selfishness and sin of misguided men struck him down, but they were powerless against the paw of the lion. And he said, "Each of us is born, lives his short life, and wearing his little apron, is laid where our forefathers have gone before us. The drama of the third degree assures us that the life from birth to death, and including both, is but an episode, a single note in the great symphony." And I read that, and it struck me very powerfully. It still does when I read it. And I realized that this sounded like something else that I'd heard before. You know? It struck me that Joseph Smith had said something very much like this.
Yeah.
And I wondered if whether or not that language that I was reading by Carl Cloudy and that I heard in Joseph Smith, that whether both of those things might have come from the same source, which would be Freemasonry. Read that, yeah. Was powerfully impressed by it, and decided as a result of that, this is something that I wanted to pursue. And so I petitioned a local lodge for membership. And I did not have, because my family had some previous involvement with Freemasonry, I didn't have some of those misconceptions.
Hang-ups, yeah.
Yep, I didn't have those. And I had not Utah culture behind me in this regard either. Now I know much more about kind of the tensions that have existed in Utah. And I think that there are, just to kind of piggyback, Lon, on what you said about this, From the Masonic perspective, there are economic exclusions that early Masons felt because many of them were Gentiles. They weren't Latter-day Saints, and they felt excluded from Brigham Young's economic order. Masons became involved in public education. They were involved in the PTA, those kinds of things. And Latter-day Saints were often at loggerheads with them over free education in Utah, and not, you know, church education, but free education. And then again, there were many good men who were ministers of other faiths in Utah who were opposed to Mormonism for whatever reason. And some of those feelings kind of bled over into the lodge. And so, and then for the reasons I think that Lon mentioned, you know, there were some concerns about upholding the law and so forth. You know, so on the Masonic side, there was that. And from for Mormons, I think it was, we've long had ambiguous, now this has been dropped, but for a long time there was ambiguous language in the Handbook of Instructions about joining secret oath-bound societies that may or may not have applied to Masons. Some people thought that it did. Others thought that it may have included other less savory groups like the Klan, you know, and it was to inhibit Latter-day Saints from participating in the Klan that, that those things were added in. But it's ambiguous is the point. And then, as has already been brought up, many people felt that the church should be sufficient. You know, that should be sufficient, that it should meet your whatever your spiritual needs are and your social needs. And why would you need to join some other group? And, you know, my own feeling about that is, well, you know, I can belong to the PTA too, and that isn't suggesting the church is not sufficient for me, right?
Right.
So there's that. And another concern was the cost and time and money to somebody who becomes a Freemason, but as Lon and every other brother here can tell you, you control that. Your amount of participation is solely at your own discretion. Most lodges meet maybe once a month, and they're off during the summer. So, you know, that's, we spend more time, I think, in front of the TV these days than is required in terms of membership for a local lodge for somebody who's just regularly attending, right?
Yeah.
But one more thing, and then there was this, there is the idea that Masonry was a positive evil because of the idea of secret combinations. Yeah? But the thing in terms of time and money, that does apply to some people. I think Elder Helvetio Martins, the council, who was in the 70 for a long time. I don't know what his status is today, but he was in the 70. But he was an active Freemason until he became a general authority and then found that his participation in Masonry really was not, that it really was invasive in terms of time, and that as a general authority, he wanted to focus his attention on his calling as a general authority. So that's the last general authority, in fact, that I'm aware of that has been involved in Freemasonry in the church, you know. So, but, so those are the issues, but I didn't have any of that kind of overlay when I became a Freemason because of my family's involvement, right?
Yeah.
I had a very positive view of that and wasted no time. And since it was already like 1994 when I did this, Lon, they were happy to see me and were happy. Although the first thing that they gave me to read was Goodwin's Mormonism and Masonry, which is probably not the best piece of literature, but I think they were trying to be honest. I think the Secretary of the Lodge is trying to be honest and say, look, we have this kind of past with Mormonism, and you should be aware of that. So maybe it was to be honest, but that is not the book that I would start with, you know, if I were investigating this topic, you know, in terms of wanting to participate in Masonry. So.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, man. Appreciate that. And you also answered a lot of questions that weren't just about your own journey. That's great to know, you know, about time and money and the different possibilities there for people. And maybe we'll get into that a little bit. But again, this is about autobiographical, you know, and deep dive with another tradition along with Mormonism and kind of the creative and neat things that come out of it through that synthesis. So anyway, thank you so much. George?
Thank you.
Would you lay into your story for us? We'd appreciate it.
So I actually think it's somewhat apropos here that Joe just presented his entrance into Masonry just before mine. I don't know if I've ever told Joe this. In large part, my journey into Freemasonry was, at least in part, due to Joe. when I got back, one of the things that's been discussed here is that many people have the conception that, in fact, Mormonism should be their end-all and be-all of their spiritual and social and intellectual path. And as I got back from my mission, I had a wonderful time in Japan and really felt, you know, a vast spiritual blossoming there. And yet when I came back from my mission and returned to my ward, I couldn't help but feel that my spiritual growth had kind of meandered and wasn't where I wanted it to be. And so one of the things I did was I began kind of a deep dive into trying to understand what Joseph Smith was about. To me, on the mission, I had the wonderful chance to listen to, what are they, the Truman Madsen Joseph Smith lecture. And, you know, he portrays Joseph Smith as this man who was, you know, directly in contact with God and, you know, had his prayers answered and almost at a moment's notice could slip into a visionary state. But more than that, but could bring those around him into those same visionary states. And so I was always fascinated by Joseph, and though I never had any desire to start a church or, for that matter, be martyred, his spiritual life was one that fascinated me. And so in order to kind of deepen that, I actually became a temple worker and worked in for a little bit of time in the baptistry at Provo. When I moved to Chicago to work on an anti-biological warfare project there, I decided to become a temple worker there and continued attending literally on a weekly basis in the temple for about 1, 2, 3, for almost 10 years after my mission. And one of the things that always drove me nuts was I loved the temple, loved the feel I got when I was there, loved the inspiration that came while I was there. But I couldn't figure, there was so much about the temple ceremony that confused and made me very confuzzled. At the same time, I was also very interested in Joseph's path. You know, how does one become a seer? How does one become a visionary? And as a result of this, I started reading on my own and realized that it's not just the Mormon tradition that has this, but almost every religious tradition, you know, whether it be a Buddhist tradition, whether it be a Shinto tradition, whether it be an Indian tradition, you know, there's been a subset of each of those religions who has been mystics, who have been able to enter into these ecstatic states and experience God. And so with this understanding, in many ways, I jumped into a group, which this is a point in time in which before Facebook, before podcasts, before any of this stuff, but there were Yahoo groups. I found a nice little group called the Mormon Mystics. And it was exactly what I needed at the time. And the founder of that group and the most active participant was a certain Joe. And
sweet.
That was me, yes. Yeah, I thought I recognized that, yes.
So one of the things that was so fascinating was that whenever I would throw out a question that had been confuzzled and driving me nuts for, you know, months on end, Joe would always come up with an answer. And it was always from the sources I never expected. And when I started trying to figure out what his sources were, about a third of the time, when I was wrestling with some Mormon historical problem or something spiritual having to do with the church, etc., I found out that about a third of his quotes were coming from Masonic authors. So with that, I started really diving into Joe and asking him for sources. And I wanted to know, well, what is Masonic ritual like? And he says, well, you know, I can't actually tell you that, but there are many, many Masonic exposés. And he pointed me to one, which was a very common one. And I for all intents and purposes, probably reread and reread that ritual 30, 40 times. Because, and I'll use an analogy here that most Mormons will be familiar with. If you just try to explain the endowment, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It's actually the experience of the endowment that is tangible. And if you actually read Masonic exposés, you're in the same situation. It's, you know, a bunch of words on a page, and you want to know, well, what does this mean? And so I began digging deeply into commentary on the Masonic rituals. And like I said, over reading these many, many times, I fell in love with the ritual. And for me, all I was really interested in at the time was the ritual. And so as I started finding myself more in love with the ritual, I started saying, well, what is this larger organization? And I remember reading a very interesting book. It's not the best book. I think there are better introductions to Masonry out there. But there's a book called Freemasonry for Dummies. And he, at the very, very end, he tells the story of why he became a Freemason. And his reasons were that his father had died. He knew his father was a Freemason. And his father had actually moved away for his retirement and didn't really know anybody. Nobody was there at his funeral except for he found out that he invited several of his father's Masonic brothers to the funeral. And they came early. They gave a very beautiful ceremony. And then they helped him clean up. And he related how since then, as he became a Freemason, that the brotherhood that he experienced within the fraternity was what kept him there. And so for me, very, very interested in the ritual, already in love with it, the chance to have these fraternal brothers was something I wanted. And so I decided in actually the same year as Patrick, just realized that in 2007, while I was in my very last year of my research, I became a Freemason. And really I've loved my brothers, wonderful guys. To kind of bounce off something that several of the guys here have talked about, it is from them, their example, that I feel like I have learned how to become a man. Freemasonry has a long tradition of, you know, trying to envelop in men values and values and a need to grow up and be mature. And I found that in the fraternity, and it's something that thrilled me. Now, you also asked the question, is there anything that worried me? Yes, I had, you know, in my own Mormon Masonic research, had found all of these, you know, situations and bans and all of those type of things. But as Lon said, by that time, I didn't need anyone to tell me how to dictate my own spiritual, social, and intellectual path. So I did. As a kind of a humorous story, years later, my extended family found out that I had become a Freemason. And they wrote me a very, very worried Facebook message saying, oh, no, so you've left the church and blah, 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 and you become a Freemason. And I wrote back to them and I said, have you ever heard of the Lions Club? Have you ever heard of Rotary Club? That's what I joined. No, I'm still a Mormon. You know, it's been so enjoyable to be involved with those charitable aspects of the fraternity. So I think that's my story.
Thank you very much. And you've hit on a couple of things here that might actually lead us for the rest of the way here. You talked about being attracted to the ritual, you know, through rereading and stuff like that, also being kind of having a mystical core to yourself. There's those parts of Freemasonry, and then you were emphasizing especially the social, the brotherhood, the men teaching men, you know, to step up and you know, take their responsibilities in the world and things like that. You got that part of it. And so those are the kind of the two places that I want to go. Before we go too much further, though, guys, let's deal with this men becoming men thing a little bit, because I have a feeling I know what you mean, but I'm not sure I do. So this isn't like gender essentialism kind of stuff, is it, where men are men and women are women and there's, you know, there's clearly defined stuff. To me, I my impression is that you guys are talking more about like how to become responsible people, to not be slackers, that kind of stuff. Or am I wrong? Is there some of both going on there?
I think I can emphatically, at least from my perspective, and I'd love to hear the other guys chime in here, gender essentialism, no, that's not what we're talking about.
So it's not like that. Men are men and women are women, and society's gone to hell when we mix that up.
No, not that at all. I'll the other guys chime in here.
Yeah, I just have to join with exactly what George has said and just say no. This is not the Klan for men.
Well, good. Good. But all of you guys have mentioned it, so I want to clear this up because I didn't think it was.
Well, if I can take just a second and say the role models that men have today mostly come off TV, and they're mostly the Homer Simpsons, the Bart Simpsons, the Wedding Crashers, and the other guys like this who just never go beyond boyhood, no matter what their age is.
Okay.
And Masonry really is a vehicle for that. And you know, a couple of years ago, Kent Nerburn wrote a book called Letters to My Son, and in there, one of the things he said was that we're born male, but men have to learn how to become men. And he went on to say that there used to be rituals in every society, and this ritual happened, and as it finished, boys were now part of manhood and a part of a clan of men who shared their experience, who shared with them the knowledge that was absolutely necessary for them to be men. And he went on, of course, to say that nothing like that existed today, because he obviously doesn't understand Masonry. But there needs to be something in a man's life. And for those who would say, well, doesn't the Aaronic priesthood do that? Doesn't being ordained into the Melchizedek priesthood do that? Perhaps it's supposed to, but it's been my experience that that's not what happens, that we do a poor job of transmitting to men, especially how it is that men are supposed to behave with other men. We might teach them how to deal with women. We might, you know, some of those kinds of things. We do talk about virtue, but it's been my experience that priesthood in general, not the power of, but the organization of, does a very poor job of teaching men how to deal with his fellow man, to be a good man with his fellow man.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a couple of comments. First, there is a misperception, I think, that Freemasonry, to people who aren't Masons, right, that Freemasonry is like a little boys' club where you have your secrets, you know, your club secrets, and
No girls allowed. Signs.
And no girls allowed. Right. That's kind of what it is. But that's a misperception, it seems to me. And as has already been stated here, Freemasonry helps us, I think, to be better men, because it provides a social context which binds men together and supports individuals in virtuous actions. It encourages virtuous behavior. It discourages, you know, irresponsible behavior by men. And the level of, I think, male irresponsibility in society today is rather high. Freemasonry really discourages that. And it provides options and alternatives, you know, for somebody who is looking for a responsible life. It traditionally teaches what it means to be a gentleman in society. And it encourages men to be gentlemen
right? I really think that it is open, as you've heard from everybody here. It encourages a certain independence of mind, and it's certainly true that among Masons that I've met, that there's kind of a self-sifting process, that people who have a certain independence of mind are attracted to the craft in a way that maybe people who do not have that kind of independence of mind, that might be something that keeps them from it. So, so that support for a gentlemanly life, a tolerant life, right? But certainly not the little boys club. And there are, of course, and I'm just going to mention this, that there are, of course, women Freemasons, and there is co-masonry, which allows women access to Masonic rituals, etc., on equal footing as men. Those are smaller movements, and I'm not associated with those personally, but I certainly don't have any bad feelings about those who do, right?
Yeah, so you guys aren't saying that this wouldn't be helpful to women because of the bad messaging that's out there as well, but you guys can only really speak from your own experience.
That's right. That's what I'm saying. So,
well, and if I can jump off on something that Lorenzo said, at the very heart of Masonic ritual is this idea of the threefold progression of a man, that one starts out as an entered apprentice, you know, someone who is a youth. And then one becomes a fellow craft, one becomes a man. And then one becomes a master mason, an old man, a wise man. One that is no longer, that is mapping his own future, building his own buildings and planning his own life. And in many ways, one of the things that I have really enjoyed is within the fraternity, I am sitting down, and I'm now in my late 30s. I am sitting down with young men who are 21. I'm sitting down with men that are 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And at the end of our rituals, at the end of our meetings, we always step down, and we call it reminding us that we are all on the level. And to, as opposed to the church priesthood system, where we segregate the 14-year-olds and the 16-year-olds and the 18-year-olds and the, you know, 20 through 40-year-olds and the 40 through whatever, when in a lodge, I get to see these men at all ages, and I get to sit down with 80-year-olds, and you know, I will tell them my problems at work, and they'll just kind of chortle because they've been through that. They've been there. They've done that. And they have such great perspective. But additionally, these are pillars of the community. And I can see myself as becoming them at the same time as I can look to the left of me and see myself at 21.
And so you mentor others as well as you're being mentored.
Mm-hmm. It's a fabulous experience. And I think in many ways, that's what I mean. And one of the interesting things you see is you see this older generation who has a very different view of the world than the younger generation. And it's so exciting to see those all together chatting. Joe mentioned that, you know, Freemasonry does attract a certain open-mindedness. In fact, it's something that's, you know, encouraged in the lodge. And to have these old guys who are 80 actually understand, though maybe I don't, maybe appreciate isn't the word, understand what attracts the 21-year-old to rap music. And the 21-year-old who understands what attracts the 80-year-old to, or you know, the 60, 70-year-old to big band music.
George, I think that's really well said all the way around. And one thing is, as I look back on some of my comments earlier, I don't want to sound like I'm denigrating priesthood or priesthood meeting in any way, but I will say that I think the church does a very good job of helping me to know how I need to approach God, how it is that I need to behave, and the rituals I need to go through for that. Masonry, for me at least, has been something that's helped me in my relationship with my fellow man. And it's exactly what George has just said. Sitting in a room with 90-year-olds on one end of the room and 21-year-olds on the other end, or 18-year-olds even, and actually not from one end to the other, but intermixed with one another. And as George said, communicating with one another, understanding one another, a beautiful thing.
Okay. Thanks so much. Thanks for that.
Can I jump in and say one other thing here? And just to kind of jump off of what has been said before, to have such a wide, vast socioeconomic scale in the lodge. We have men who are blue collar and men who are serving. In my last lodge, one of the guys was a high-ranking government official. To have them sitting together is something that is exciting. To have Muslims and Sikhs and I live in Ann Arbor, and so a very mixed population there, sitting down right beside very evangelical Christians, and and having them actual talk and seeing each other and interacting with each other is a really exciting thing.
Awesome.
I wanted to comment on that, Clinton, because that was really important to me too. There are men of many different faiths in my local lodge, and they have served in every position in the lodge. And I want to just point out how that breaks down stereotypes and social barriers. When you hear something, for example, about a Muslim outside of the lodge, and you know that there is a brother in your lodge who's a Muslim that you've associated with for a very long time, you are less likely to be persuaded by somebody's opinion over what you've experienced yourself. And that has been very, very important, a very important part of my experience as a Freemason, to be able to associate with men whom otherwise I would not be able to associate with. And of course, in the early constitutions, the 1723 constitutions by Anderson, that was the point, right, where Masonry becomes the center of union for men who otherwise might remain or must remain at a perpetual distance, right? Freemasonry becomes this point of union, the center of union, the thing that brings people together, because there are so many worthwhile things that as Masons we can share apart from those things that separate us. And one last thing is the best answer for a Latter-day Saint, who might be kind of, I don't know about that. One Latter-day Saint who later joined my lodge said this to, convince, I don't know, he wasn't going to convince me, he was preaching to the choir, but he said, righteous man, he was talking about Latter-day Saint prophets and leadership, righteous men have joined the lodge, and I want to do what those righteous men have done. And that for him, this was a way for him to reclaim a part of his own heritage as a Latter-day Saint, things that Latter-day Saints in the past had done, that he was able to share with them. And, hopefully that was a benefit for his life. I think that it was. But I really liked his perspective on that and wanted to share that here. So,
hey, well, you guys, just from the direction this has gone, I guess me sending you into the men becoming men and all that stuff, it looks like we flip-flopped the order in which I was planning to do stuff. So let's just go full on with anything else about the social aspect, the brotherhood aspect. So anything else you want to talk about? That part of being a Mason, and especially, and again, you don't have to focus only on this, but especially we've kind of heard so far where it's picking up the slack, where Mormonism kind of isn't doing anything. Is there anything, like, because of your interactions with Brotherhood, that you now see priesthood quorums differently, or that you see something about, even Mormon teachings about the family, or all of us God's children, all of us brothers and sisters? Is there anything like that that kind of works its way from Masonry into your Mormon life and makes it richer?
I have a story about that, Dan, if you don't mind. This is Patrick.
Please. Yes.
So as a little bit of a preamble, I mentioned too the whole idea about gentlemen and listening to these three brothers who, by the way, they're all mentors to me. So it's I should really be paying you money, Dan, to be putting this on. It's wonderful to sit and listen to these guys. But so when I mentioned earlier about gentlemen, then I'll get into my priesthood story. What I've learned from Masonry as far as the social side and in ritual, it's all intertwined in my opinion, how the social and the ritual side, because I learned how to be a better man through ritual. But for me, Masonry and being a gentleman, as people had alluded to before, there are different walks of life within the lodge. I get to be sitting next to somebody who's far smarter than I am, a lawyer or a successful businessman, but I am taken serious by them. And there were many different Protestant faiths at my ceremony, a Catholic, a Muslim, and a Jew, and I'm a Mormon, and we are all brothers, and we are sons of God, and we recognize that. But what I was saying earlier about the gentleman side is Masonry, for me anyway, has shown the importance of situation and nuance. There is a time to put on a tuxedo. There is a time to be serious. And there is a way to approach one another with politeness. And tolerance is not just putting up with something and rolling your eyes and being quiet until whoever you disagree with is quiet. Tolerance is understanding. And then in addition to that, with the ritual, with what I've learned is, and Long can attest to this as being an orator, a grand orator for the Grand Lodge, if you were to deliver a message or a speech or convey anything, it's very important how you do that, how you hold yourself, how you speak, the way you use inflections of your voice. And there is a time to dress appropriately. And as I mentioned before, it's wearing a tuxedo and an important ritual just sets the mood. It completely reshapes the way it lets people know that you're going to go through a transformative experience. So your question, Dan, earlier, how does this play into priesthood and how within quorums? So I had a discussion with my bishop, my current bishop, a few months ago, and he was lamenting, as bishops do, how the elders' quorum reacts in elders' quorum. We all seem bored. I mean, most people in church do seem bored. And so I just was frank with him. This is the first time I told him I'm a Freemason, and like everybody else here, I never felt like I had to go ask for permission because I am my own captain. But I just told him, I'm a Freemason, so let me tell you what I think about this. In Masonry, we have our quick little, hey, how are you? How's your week? Well, we're getting the lodge ready. And then when the lodge is about to open, it opens. We set off a space that is, this may be a loaded word, but dedicated to the understanding that we are going to have an experience now. And at the end of it, we close the lodge. And so I told him, in Elders' Quorum, we kind of have our quick opening introductions. The scouts talk about what they're going to do. Everybody slouches back in their seat. And then we all break for individual quorums. And whoever's teaching the lesson will grab the manual and talk about how he didn't really have time to prepare for anything. And then we all just take turns reading from the manual. And so I told him, in my opinion, and Joseph understood completely this with Masonry when it has to do with the temple endowment and setting up a quorum as well. It would be nice if we could if we can have some kind of a formal opening outside of just a prayer and have somebody lead more or less a lodge, but I'm calling it a quorum since it's priesthood, and give to one another and have a transformative experience with understanding that we are about to impart knowledge, and then we are going to close this quorum at the end of it and go back to our families and be good priesthood members. And of course, he was polite and listened to me, but he didn't quite get it, and I understood that he didn't because it's not in the handbook. And yeah. As I mentioned before, as Masons, we're captains of our own ship, and if there's something that needs to be done, we do it, and we build, and we innovate. So, you know, I don't hold a grudge about that. thinking the next question in my mind is, well, what do I do with that? So when I have an opportunity to teach, I'm a bit more formal, and I address people seriously in the quorum, and I make eye contact with them, and to let them know that what they're saying or sharing is important. I get them to open up, and I've noticed that people sit up a bit more, and they put down their cell phones, and
So just a conscious making of this time separate from the time that came before and the time that will come after. Just that's, you know, huge in ritual theory, that you have sort of rites of separation from day-to-day life. Then you move into a liminal period, a threshold period. In, you know, the Greek have a term called kairos time, K-A-I-R-O-S, where it's that time of anything could happen, expectation. It's not normal. So this is this. And then you close and you reintegrate back into life. But hopefully, because you were in that separate time and space for a while, you re-enter normal Chronos time at a little bit higher level. You're vibrating with better ideas or whatnot, and so it affects your life that way. And so you're just talking about the consciousness of creating that space and time. I think that's wonderful and fantastic.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say one more quick thing. Speaking of when we were talking about women and their role, what really excites me of the possibility of Mormonism is that at the exact same time, the Relief Society can be closing off and sharing their own experience within their feminine priesthood. That's a completely different podcast, but that's the exciting aspect of Mormonism. The women will be having their own enlightenment, and I hope at some point the quorums, as it were, we can all have our enlightenment within our quorum meetings. And I say quorum is with females in mind too, women, Relief Society. So yeah. All right, I'll shut up now.
No, that's good stuff. And, you know, obviously Joseph Smith certainly felt with the School of the Prophet that it was something, he was trying to approach this, and we had that great, you know, greeting and whatnot somewhere in section 88 in the 120s, verses 120s or something, where I greet you, or thou art a brother, art thou a brother, etc. That kind of stuff is really what you guys are consciously doing too in some ways, right?
If you heard
Joe,
a chuckle,
you're not chortling with me, are you?
If you heard a chuckle there, Dan, it's because that greeting is Masonic.
Oh, is it? You know, okay. It's totally straight from it.
Yeah, exactly. I want you to stop and think about what those rituals looked like, you know, to somebody in those days, right? It is a ritualized greeting, and it's followed by a period of confidential instruction. And this is a Masonic model. Joseph Smith is experimenting, it seems to me, with Masonic models, right? In Mormonism, from very early on, he's doing this, right? And so if you heard any kind of sniggering or chortling in the background, I know that Clint and I have discussed this. I think maybe Patrick and I have. And Lon, I'm sure that you see it. I mean, it's quite evident that this is a Masonic model that Joseph Smith is experimenting with. So...
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And honestly, right from the beginning, although I know that there are Mormon historians all over who are rolling over in their grave right now as I say that.
So, okay.
So whereas we have the impression that he joined in Nauvoo, you're basically saying he's influenced right from the early 1830s.
From the get-go. But we'll say that from the Kirtland period, you can demonstrate this by just looking at what you were discussing. Yeah.
Right. So. This kind of stuff. But the broader picture, I think, of an alerting to ritual time and space, a different character than average stuff, that stuff is huge in Masonry. And to me, that's a way great enhancement of Mormonism and Mormon life. And we can more consciously do that.
Yeah. Thanks, Patrick. That was a great comment, too.
Thank you.
Other guys on stuff from the Brotherhood social... kind of things that enhance your Mormonism or at least make Sundays more interesting to you?
One of the things that I have enjoyed about Masonry that I think would be a benefit to Mormonism in quorums, you know, in terms of quorum activity, is that you have to have activities that inspire people, you know, rather than simply passing around the list of, you know, who is going to have the missionaries over for dinner or who's going to help brother so-and-so, you know, move this month, finding and focusing one's attention on a worthwhile charitable activity that inspires the mind, you know.
here in Washington State, there's a real effort to involve every lodge in some charitable activity that fires the mind of the brethren in that lodge, right? So, and then the Grand Lodge itself has various charitable endeavors, including supporting Habitat for Humanity, those kinds of things, where brethren can go out as brethren and support each other in those kinds of activities. And I think that is wonderful.
Great. Thank you. George or Lon?
One of the comments George made had to do with falling in love with the ritual. And I suspect that all four of us on this call have had that experience. He fell in love with it before he joined. I fell in love after. But I think one of the reasons I fell in love with that ritual is because I watched the changes that it made almost imperceptibly in my life. My wife picked up on them before I did. She started to see things happening with me that I guess they were happening so slowly from my point of view, I didn't see them. But now as I watch in the lodge that I belong to, having sat as a worshipful master for a period of time, doing a lot of mentoring and coaching of new candidates as they come through, especially now as a past master, worried about how it is that we develop men to fill the roles, to be ready to be a worshipful master, especially young men who are coming out, out of the colleges in droves here in Utah and joining us, even out of BYU, UVU, the University of Utah, Utah State, even our southern colleges. We're beginning to see an awful lot of young men come in pretty large numbers. And the only generation that seems to be missing is the Vietnam generation, frankly. But we're seeing this happen, and I don't know whether Joe and George are seeing that and
need to give them the seasoning and the maturity that they need so that they can lead a lodge and do those things.
I can speak from my experience. There are a lot of young people who are coming into masonry here in Washington State as well. And the other thing, Lon, is that they are really interested not simply in the social aspects of masonry or even the charitable aspects of masonry. They are hungry for the esoteric content of masonry. And sometimes they are encouraged to join lodges that focus on that particular area in masonry. I've seen a lot of that. They're hungry for their perception of masonry as a repository of esoteric wisdom and knowledge as well. So, but my experience is kind of like the, you know, my raising. That was such a meaningful thing to me, and it has only increased over time, you know, talking about loving the ritual, that even when I have problems in life, I'm not alone. That there are brethren who will lift me up and help support me when I need it most, right? And they physically depict that as a part of the ritual.
Yeah, beautiful. George?
So one thing that has very much enriched me, Freemasonry, in one of the charges they give after you become an entered apprentice, is they encourage you to attend the meetings as much as one can. However, that the lodge should never interfere with your duties to God, your neighbor, or your fellow man. And to me, that means when I show up at lodge, it is not by obligation, but because I want to be there. I know that if I can't make it because of a family emergency or just because my daughter needs more time with me, there's just no guilt. Nice. I don't feel bad about not going. But at the same time, when I am there, I am dwelling together with my brothers in unity. That voluntary nature of the craft to me is one that I wish that more Mormons shared with their own Mormonism. I sit in quorum meetings too often, and those guys are there not because they want to be, but because that's where they're supposed to
You're commanded to be here. There's a heavy trip to that can throw the guilt on you. Now, that's interesting. So you're saying you would like to see Mormonism have a better sense of, you guys have, or at least Patrick used the term, you're your own captain. You can kind of decide when it's the right time and set your own priorities and things like this. So I agree with you there that Mormonism needs that. On the other hand, though, you guys would say that if you are an officer of the lodge, just like when you're in Mormonism, if you are a teacher of a class, you need to show up. Otherwise, it all falls apart. But otherwise, you'd probably... Would all of you be in agreement with what George just said?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, me too. And yes, you do have to do more than show up. You have to be prepared. You know, there are as Lon is indicating, there we spend a great amount of time in Masonry, in preparing people to lead the lodge, right? So that they can feel confident as they move around in the different offices in the lodge, the different stations in the lodge, that by the time they arrive in the East and they're going to be the master of the lodge, right? And their brethren can vote for them in confidence because they are prepared. And, you know, so there's great stress laid on that in the Masonic jurisdiction that I'm in currently. And I believe that that's something that we could emulate in some way, I think, in the church. I think helping men to be prepared in that way.
But doing it by choice in this case, you know, instead of like, oh, I'm called of God because somebody else's inspiration did it. It's like, no, I've chosen to get in the line to move up to the different officer ranks.
Right. I have prepared myself. I've made the effort to do that because I'm willing to, you know, step into that kind of role should I be needed. Yes. I think that's really, really important. And I also wanted to focus on the other end of that. I love... And in my jurisdiction, it's monitorial, but I'm not going to repeat it here because it's not monitorial in every jurisdiction. But at the end of a lodge meeting here, there is the master's charge. And the master tells the brethren that the principles that they have learned in the lodge extend beyond the brethren in the lodge. And they're enjoined to do good unto all, that every person has a claim upon their kind offices, that they should work to do good unto all. And I think that's really important. You know, we do the things that we do in a quorum in the church because it's a training ground for us. But I don't think Latter-day Saints necessarily have that idea that, well, we're doing this because it's my quorum duty. But no, the reason why you're learning how to do that in the quorum is because you have a broader responsibility to society that this is preparing you for. And I don't think that we always have that kind of a view.
So it'd be, yours is basically saying if you could change something, maybe there'd be a ritualized sending off at the end of our quorum meetings to do something that, you know, you're now, we've ended the discussion, class time is about to end, here's the charge. You like that?
Dan,
oh, I'd love a charge.
Dan, that sounds brilliant to me, actually. We're about to send you out into the world to go do good. Something along those lines would be wonderful. I look at the separation between members of the church and those who are not in my neighborhood, in my ward boundaries here in South Jordan, and how hard we try to get people to mix. And then I also, from time to time, I hear criticisms of my Masonry coming back from members of the church because I'm sitting in lodges with men who are not of my faith.
Wow.
And what am I doing there? What kind of things am I soaking up from them? And where am I going? And when I say to them things like, honestly, these are the best men I know, they're shocked. They think there's something terribly wrong with me at that point. And it's just kind of sad that we don't get that we're really supposed to be Christian to all, and not just to those of our quorum, not just to those of our faith, not just to those of our neighborhood, as long as they're part of the faith.
So here's a thought, and it's rhetorical. Based on what Lon just said, isn't it interesting that Joseph first had the saints in Nauvoo go through the lodge, join Masonry as a stepping stone to the greater knowledge of the endowment? And, like I said, it's rhetorical, but think of that.
Well, and fascinating to me too, Patrick, that when he set up the room above his red brick store for the first endowments. It was Master Masons in good standing. I think I'm a little out on a limb when I say this next piece. I believe they were Masons predating their Mormonism, the two of them that he asked. But he asked them to set up the room. And neither of them had a problem with this new endowment conflicting with their old ritual or the old ritual being superseded in some way. They were very comfortable with all of that they did. And I could see where the one is a stepping stone to the other.
Interesting. Good stuff. Hey guys, I don't want to go too much longer. So have we come to a close on the social brotherhood kind of piece of it? And I do want to give everybody a round to kind of talk about some ideas that are in Masonry at the philosophical level, something about the human soul or spirit or, you know, the great power of the universe, whatever you'd want to call it. I know the G, there's controversies or not, there's disagreements that what it stands for, but mostly it ends up being geometry, I think, is the main interpretation of that. So I'd like to see if there's anything left on social, but I would love to get at least a philosophical taste and how that plays into your Mormonism. So who can start with that? George, maybe your turn? I don't know. We'll go out of order, but...
Sure, be happy to. So I'm going to jump back just a little bit. One of the questions you were kind of asking was, how does our experiments in Freemasonry affect how we view church, etc.?
Right.
One of the things that I shouldn't leave without noting, me and Patrick chat all the time. And often our conversations turn to this Mormon Masonic connection, not surprisingly. I have to say that my continued interest in Mormonism, at least in a good chunk, is due to this Mormon Masonic connection. I meet so many people that are worried that, you know, exploring these issues will somehow be a thing that will break their testimony. And yet, and I hope Patrick will agree with me here, in fact, it has been something that has enriched, deepened, enlivened, and added so much humor to my view of the church and what Jones Smith was doing. It's just so incredibly fascinating to see what Joseph did with Freemasonry and what he did with the religion.
Okay, before you get too far away from the word humor, comment on that a little bit more.
And I think Joe will attest this to this as well. In studying what's going on, I just so often find myself chortling. That's what Joseph was doing? Oh, my heavens, I can't believe that. And it's just so fascinating because it's so complex what he's doing, and yet it's almost it has a humorous tinge to it. I don't know if I helped you out there.
Well, no. Is it more like you're laughing because of the boldness? He's really trying to go that big? Okay, so
yeah,
it's not like humor as in like big. Silly Joseph. It's
no,
like,
no,
dude.
Not at all.
Okay.
It's that he's going that big. And that the other thing that makes me laugh is, oh my heavens, this has been sitting in plain sight for how long and I never noticed it. And I can't help but laugh at that.
That's cool. Yeah, that's you hit the exact track that I'm looking for here. So thank you. And if you want to keep going, or if anybody else wants to say something again at this sort of level, we haven't gotten to any specific teachings or ideas about, you know, humans and all that stuff yet. So is anybody else at that level that George just played with us?
I can jump in if you want. So, yeah, I completely concur with what George said. He and I talk weekly, and one thing that has changed me over the years is I've understood that there's a distance between man and God. But what Joseph was teaching is that we have to approach God in order to receive revelation. And I understand now that Joseph wasn't just hanging out and was deemed a prophet and received a dictation from God on anything. It was Joseph had to approach God. And so as George mentioned, in our discussions, when we look at really what Joseph was doing and that there was masonry from the very beginning, I understand how I can approach God better, and I understand that Joseph was really working on something. Absolutely, he wasn't a con man, even though he made some awful choices at times, but he was building the most in-depth religion I've come across. And so no matter how I look at my testimony now, I should say, and that's a loaded word because I have a testimony of this church. George mentioned that sometimes people get worried if you go too deep into studying other aspects that could hurt your testimony. What I want to say is that it's enlivened it.
It's because you sense that Mormonism has the bigness that he's
pointing
to. Yeah,
absolutely. And we're not even near what Joseph was trying to do. So, anyway.
Yeah, no, that's where I would have guessed that it is there. When you see something like George says, it's there all along. You know, that's the kind of stuff that Mormonism, I mean, I've never seen it be small, you know, except when you get to the cultural parts of it. But when it comes to gospel and the basic starting points and what this world and universe and everything are all about, it is huge. And so when you guys now come to it, through masonry, you know, you're not carrying the baggage that is all the culture of Mormonism and all the discussions on Sunday that keep it small. So in masonry, as you guys are playing in the big picture, now all of a sudden it's just so much easier to see that the big picture of Mormonism is there too. Does that seem like a right dynamic?
Yeah, and one last thing, I'll say this and then I'll let anybody else talk. Not only has it been a launching pad masonry, but I understand what Joseph, he wasn't thinking three steps ahead of everybody. He was more like 35 steps ahead. When we look at alchemy and Kabbalism within, and he mixed it all in into this religion, not because he was trying to build something. As well, I should say, yeah, maybe he was trying to build something, but it was always there. He was organizing it, and that's what our theology is. God took a matter and organized it. And then one interesting note, I think it was Joe mentioned that, or Lon mentioned that people are coming into Lodge, young men, because they want the philosophical approach. They want the meaty stuff that masonry has to offer. We just don't want to sit around and plan a picnic. Well, I noticed the same thing within my priesthood quorum. And not only men, but women too. I mean, good grief. There are fantastic views coming from both men and women about these mysteries of Mormonism that just need to be untapped. And I don't want to rag on the religion, just to rag on the religion, but I want to point out it's interesting that this is the world that we're living in now. People want to plunge those depths.
Yeah. Very interesting.
I have a comment that kind of jumps into a philosophical point and also kind of talks about the social aspects that we've already discussed. And I would like to phrase it as a protestation. I object to the proposition that's been made by people like Matt Brown and several others very recently, that Freemasonry teaches about the relationship between men as a fraternal brotherhood, but that our instruction in the temple, for instance, concerns the relationship of men and women with God. And I just want to point out that is a polemical argument, you know, it's fundamentally wrong. It's intended to distance, and I think inaccurately misrepresents kind of what Masonry teaches. I think that it's problematic. Masonry's allegorical instruction has a lot to say about the relationship of the individual to God and treats that at length, but it also notes that our relationship with our fellow man has to do with our relationship with God. Those things are not so easily separable. Nice. Right? So, you know, if you look at the Ten Commandments, for example, the first four of them, you know, have to do with God, but the last six of them have to do with our social obligations. Right? So, you know, you don't lie, you honor your father and your mother, you don't murder, you don't commit adultery, you don't steal, you don't covet, right? Our social interactions reflect directly upon our relationship with God, and that's why those things are there. And Joseph Smith understood that relationship really, really well. He said, when the Savior shall appear, we shall see that he is a man like ourselves. And that's important for what he says next. We shall see that he's a man like ourselves, and that the same sociality which exists among us here will exist among us there, only it will be coupled with eternal glory, which glory we do not now enjoy. That's DNC 130, 1 and 2. And that's a restatement in LDS scripture, the argument in 1 John 4:20, that if anybody says that they love God and they hate his brother, that they're a liar.
Exactly.
Right? So he's restating that, but he's restating it in very Mormon terms when he points out the reason why that's true isn't simply because we don't see God, but because God is like us, right? And so you're lying if you say you can treat your fellow man in such and such a way, and that doesn't reflect on your relationship with God. So this is a false dichotomy that has been created by polemicists in the church, I think, who are worried about Freemasonry and what that might mean for the gospel, right? So, but it's false. It's simply a false way of approaching that. And the other thing is that when you're endowed, you make specific covenants, you know, covenants of obedience, the law of the gospel, chastity, consecration, and all of those have aspects directly related to virtuous social interaction. You know, think about the law of consecration, right, which pertains to supporting the building up of the kingdom of God, the establishment of Zion. Ask yourself what Zion is. What's the kingdom of God, right? What are those things? Well, Zion is a pure in heart. It's the church and its stakes. It's the city of Enoch, the city of Jerusalem, the new Jerusalem, the society of exalted beings, right? It's all of those things, the dwelling place of those people who are exalted. So you see the problem with the argument that lodges, you know, only deal with our relationship with our fellow man, but you know, Mormonism deals with our relationship with God. Well, that's problematic, I think, as a Freemason. I see those things as connected. Yes.
Yeah, totally. Yep. And the flow from God, being right with God, that's the fruits of the Spirit, are all those things that the love and the charity, the patience, and all those things are a fruit from, that comes from a centering in the right perspective of who we are in relationship with God, with just our own, you know, our own divine eternal selves. There's that right connection to where, what is it, chicken or egg? You know, sometimes, you know, you do the social things right and that helps you get in touch with God. But I always like to say, if you've spent time every single day knowing who you are and centered in the right spots, the rest of the stuff just kind of erupts from you as a natural flow into the rest. But you're right, they're just intimately connected. You can't even take them apart. So fantastic. Anybody else on the social stuff? Otherwise, I want at least to give listeners who haven't really heard anything about some of the specific teachings of Masonry. Maybe, you know, it doesn't have to be a lot, but just sort of what's the starting point from it, and then from this, how is your Mormonism enhanced?
So I'll take that piece on. This is Lon.
Yeah, thanks.
I'll jump in, but very basic. I'll just say this is very basic. So as Masons, we're taught that symbolism is all around us in the lodge room, that it's in almost every word of our ritual, and that that G that you refer to, there are different meanings that go with it. We're also taught, however, that no man can interpret those symbols for us. They do have what we call their lawfully accepted meanings, but that they can mean a variety of things for us. And I think that it was that teaching which unlocked the temple for me. It's not that I hadn't been faithful in that, but when you walk into a room, when you're in that process, whether it's in the Salt Lake Temple or in any of the others, You are going through that hero's journey that's there, and you're on your way from and then back to, and you go through all of that process, and you are surrounded by symbols. There's not just a couple here and there. And again, almost every word. And we've learned that as faithful LDS members, that there are meanings at different levels, that it may mean this to some at this point, and as they deepen their knowledge, they discover it means that, and there's also this other thing. And I think that teaching having to do with the fact that we're surrounded by symbols, that we have to interpret those symbols, and that there may be multiple meanings that are all correct or all equally wrong, whichever you like, about those meaning or about those symbols, is very much in tune. And again, it's one of the areas where Masonry unlocked some, as George said, the moment when you say, it's been here all along and I've never seen it before. Just those pieces.
Yeah, beautiful. Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Is it because in Mormonism, you generally grow up thinking that the Genesis story is literal, or is it really an Adam and Eve or something like that? And so you're in the temple and you're reenacting, scenes from what you see as literal lives of these people. Whereas in Masonry, you pretty much know right from the start that you're in symbolic world. You're not in literal world here. Is it the fact that you're able to cross over and enjoy symbolism and the kinds of insights that can come from multivalent, meanings and all these different things? Is it because you're free from the heavy trip of, Adam and Eve were a literal character, that was Michael, and he really did this? And is it because of that maybe it unlocks the temple that way for you, because now all of a sudden you're more fully able to say, it's symbolic too?
I think so. And I also think that maybe the other brothers on this phone don't feel the same as I do, but I've come to a place where I really don't care if it's literal. It doesn't matter anymore.
Sure.
I care about what it is that it gives me, and it teaches me, and it moves me forward. But there may be characters in the Old Testament that I'll never meet on the other side because they didn't exist.
Exactly.
And I'm not bothered by that at this point in my life.
Yeah.
That's just there. One other comment I'll add, which has nothing to do with things we've learned. I will say that I don't know any active LDS Masons in Utah who thought that Matthew Brown's book was a great thing. And the reason was that, like so much of the Mormons and Masons literature that's out there today, that's written by Mormons, trivializes the fraternity and trivializes the experiences that men have there. And I'll step out and make the bold claim, I've made it before, I think every good man would benefit from an experience in Masonry. It's not for everybody, we often say, but that's because some would not take it seriously, some are not worthy of it. But the fact is, every good man I know would benefit from that experience, and every good member of the church would also, every good man in the church would also experience wonderful things if they would allow themselves to.
Awesome.
Amen.
Anybody else? Jump in, please.
I wanted to agree 100% with everything that Lon said. Everything that he said. No disagreements here. I don't think that any Mormon Freemason is likely to disagree with that. I'm totally on board, Lon. I do have something specific that I thought, talking about how our one experience informs the other. And that's been that way for me, that my experience as a Freemason has informed my experience as a Latter-day Saint, and the other way around when it comes to points of philosophy, doctrine, and the meaning of symbolism. You talk about what unlocks the temple. And I want to point to a very specific example that I don't think will offend anybody. Stop me if you've heard this before, if you don't want to talk about it. But I was thinking about, when you first enter a lodge, or before you enter the lodge, you give what are known as the three distinct knocks, right? And those knocks can mean several things. The threefold knocking can refer, if you're a Christian, to the passage in Matthew 7, ask, seek, and knock. It can be just a general knocking on heaven's door, right? Knocking for information.
But it can also represent, if you connect it with the earliest Masonic stories, with the three great knocks or blows of death, the three great knocks. You know, something has been lost in Masonry. And how is it lost? Well, it was lost by the death of the master in Masonry, you know, who serves an allegorical purpose. Well, how did he die? By three great knocks. Now, at the door of the lodge, we give three distinct knocks.
So right? Three great knocks to the head? Or are you talking like the method of killing him?
Or? Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Three great knocks. He died by three great knocks, by his death. How did he die? By three great knocks. And it refers to the blows of death, right? The three blows of death. It's very symbolic. Now, Joseph Smith, whoever is responsible for the final arrangement of the endowment, moves those three distinct knocks to the end of the ceremony. And it's a brilliant bit because it suggests one's death at the end of life, prior to passing into what Masons would call the Celestial Lodge above, right? Yet the candidate is still alive. And it reinforces this idea of the immortal nature of man and alludes to the idea that our current life, with its apparent beginning and ending, isn't the whole story. Right? And what in Masonry is refers to as life in the midst of eternity, right? As Cloudy said, you know, in that quote that I gave earlier on. So that's brilliant. The moving of the three knocks to the end of the ceremony where they represent death. Or could represent death. I'm not going to be dogmatic about that, but the moving of them that way is a brilliant bit. It's profoundly significant.
So by knowing its origins in Masonry, it has given you new things to think about in the endowment.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
You know, and notice how it is associated with the passing through of a veil.
Right.
Nice. Which is, it's death. It's death, right? We're talking about, I think. So, yeah, and absolutely, that's the point. The point is that when I think about Masonry, it informs my experience. It informs the kinds of questions that I ask about the ritual. Masonry is about the loss of something significant, and that loss occurs to every person in the world, and our search to recover it. And in the meantime, we have things that kind of substitute for it. And so one of the questions that I had going through the endowment is the ceremony at the veil. You're asking for something very specific. And I had to ask myself if what I received at the veil was the thing that I asked for, or whether it was a substitute for the thing that I asked for, because nobody could actually give me what I was really asking for except for God. Right? The idea, some would draw the distinction too, that the Masonic temple is all about allegory and symbol, whereas some polemicists like Matt Brown, along you're just talking about, would say, but the Mormon temple is a real temple.
Yeah.
And isn't allegorical. Well, no, actually, it's quite allegorical. It's all allegorical, you know. The whole thing is for allegorical instruction, just as Masonic ritual is. Right. And yeah. I think people who separate those things miss a point. Right.
Exactly.
And you are free to ask those kinds of questions. You should be free and to ask those kinds of questions about what the endowment might mean. And Masonry for me, I'm certain for the other brothers here that Masonry provides information that can inform the kinds of questions that we ask about what the endowment means.
Yeah, that's great. That's exactly where I hope somebody would focus. So,
going back to that, the Matthew Brown piece for just a moment, you know, our enemies, Masonry has enemies, and our enemies attack us on three fronts, really. And they're the three fronts which we state right up front are things we are not. We are not trivial. We are not selfish. That is, only worried about self. And we're not ungodly. And yet those are the things that most people line up against us with. And the one that's the most effective is actually this business that we're trivial, that we're not important, that we're not relevant, that we're a boys' club, that we have nothing to offer. And And that really was what it was that, I mean, with every chapter almost, and I know he's passed away. I don't want to take shots at the dead, but at the same time, that is the pattern of almost every Mormons and Masons book written by Mormons. And it's as if they need to make sure that they distance themselves from any Masonic beginnings so that it doesn't in some way taint the spirituality of it all. And yet, as you can see from Joe's comments, the spirituality of it has been nothing but enhanced by our experiences in our lodges. I would say today I have a stronger testimony that God lives and that Joseph Smith was a prophet based upon my experiences in lodge than I had for decades from maybe my missionary experience. I think George was the one who said it's enlivened it for him, and yeah, maybe that was nice. Patrick as well. It has. When I'm reading my scriptures these days, there are things that stand out to me. There are things that jump out at me. And by the way, Joe, your comments about polar side of God versus man, that whole piece was really well said, I thought. And I wholeheartedly echo it.
All you guys are dang articulate, I'll tell you. You can just tell that you guys spend serious time thinking about these things, and there's a fruit here of just this incredible mix of, you know, extreme intelligence, but also commitment to doing good, and just articulateness. And it reminds me a little bit of kind of where I was going to go a little bit after Joe. Of, you know, he mentioned something in there about, you know, we're all born into this world with certain gifts, and we kind of lose them, and the thing is to regain it. And in the lodges, you've got these steps, and there's different disciplines printed on them, and one of them is rhetoric, for instance, as we're talking about becoming more articulate and things like this. But this sort of rebuilding ourselves from, how Gnostic is Freemasonry? Is it that sense of the eternal? I guess this is really where I came in thinking somebody would focus. We are this eternal soul. That was, again, your quote at the beginning, Joe. We are this eternal creature. What is it? Is it just life? Is it the messaging we get? Is it the Bart Simpson as our model? What has buried all this stuff for us? And then it's an ascent theology. It's an ascent, A-S-C-E-N-T, ascending to reclaim ourselves kind of thing going on there. So I don't even know what my question is anymore. I guess I'm just trying to say, what is Masonry? Teach the Masonry about that really quickly, and then we'll see if we can draw the connection to Mormonism.
So there's probably better answers out there among the others on this, but you know, we start from a basis of the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and the immortality of the soul.
Okay.
Beyond that, when it comes to religion, beyond that, what we talk about is, we're not a path to salvation. We don't have saving ordinances. That is left up to the individual conscience. That is left up to their religion. And that is what it is, along with the injunction that we don't talk about religion in lodges, and we don't talk about politics, because those are the things that divide men. Beyond that, that's what makes it possible for me to sit next to a Jewish brother on one side, a Catholic on the other, and a Muslim across the room.
Okay,
and discuss
great
importance.
Yeah, no, but you don't talk about it, but yet you're all very aware of everybody else's religion here. So this has come up a few times in my head here.
Yeah, not so often, actually. It's a question we usually leave unasked. If we find out that we're sitting next to a Jew, it's because he tells us, not because we ask.
Okay.
And the other thing I would say is, we talk about ethical truths. We talk about things that all religion accepts as truth on a regular basis. And that, I think, the opening of the eyes for Lon has been, about 90% of what all religion believes, we all believe. And there's only the ritual, there's only
the flavor.
The flavor. There's only that piece that's different. Now, that's not to say And we have degrees where we discuss this. That's not to say that we believe all religion is equal, because we don't. I don't. I believe that mine is correct and true and leads me to salvation and to greater things. But that does mean that we don't denigrate the other. And if you'd like me to tell you the biggest thing I think I've learned in Masonry about my religion, it is that others are also inspired, that others also have a way and a path, and it may not lead where mine leads, and they may need a piece of mine at some point, but in most cases, I've got big portions of theirs, which also came from inspired sources.
Thanks. Anybody else want to jump in more on the eternal or mortal soul kind of clouded over and this sort of ascent that is the basics of this?
I wanted to focus on the word ascent, because you've used that, and I wanted to point out something about that. There are those who say, and I could name them, that there is no such thing in Freemasonry, that the concept of ascent is lacking in Masonry. And I would point out that that is not true, that every degree in Masonry has something to do with ascent. In the first degree, we have Jacob's theological ladder. In the second degree, there is a winding stair. And in the third degree, there is a raising. And if you accept the Royal Arch as a part of ancient craft Masonry, then there is definitely an ascent, and it's associated with the backstory of the Royal Arch, which has to do with the Enoch's ascent. And that tradition, that fourth degree, is also called the Rite of Exaltation, and Mormonism borrows that language, right? So is there an ascent in Masonry? Yes. But to nod my head in Lon's direction, I would say what that ascent means is for every brother to decide for himself. I would not lecture a brother on how he had to see that. But let me say that if you are a Christian or a Latter-day Saint and a Freemason, then that suggests something very particular, right? That suggests something very particular, where we ascend a stair and receive wages. And I won't be any more specific than that, but that also exists in Masonry, that we ascend step by step into the presence of the divine.
Right.
So.
Well, I picked up on the ascent thing right away. I don't know how some would deny that that's part of it. So that's thanks for clarifying.
Yeah.
Anybody else on just something esoteric teaching-wise that you know that there's a connection with Mormonism, and because you've found it in Masonry, it has now exploded for you in your Mormon thinking?
I can leave some of my thoughts because George is far smarter than I, so he should probably leave his at the end.
Okay. So should we do a round of final kind of things? I think that's we're kind of gotten to that point where, yeah, why don't you just wrap up here, Patrick, but, okay, you know, address that part of it for me if you want to. Otherwise,
sure,
go around.
So the so you're asking about connections with Masonry and Mormonism that have exploded since I've become a Mason.
Well, I'm thinking more teaching-wise, a particular teaching in Masonry or an emphasis in Masonry.
Okay.
But again, you don't have to follow me.
Sure. Yeah, well,
I'm saying it.
What I was thinking when I was listening to all my distinguished brothers speak is it's completely unsayable for me. There's a term in Masonry called ineffable, and I cannot, George mentioned earlier, you cannot know it without experiencing it. I could show you on a printed page both the temple ritual, the LDS temple endowment, and the Masonic degrees, and it really would mean nothing until you've experienced it. So one thing that, in just my thoughts and hearing other people talk, one thing I've learned with Masonry, as others have mentioned, the power of allegory and imagery, and within Masonry we are taught about Hiram Abiff, and we become Hiram Abiff. There is absolutely no way to teach the powerful elements by just giving a lecture. It has to be through allegory. So that gave me that charged me with understanding as I delve deeper into Mormonism, instead of being let down by some of the quote untruths or the unliteralness, I should say, it elevated it for me. So in Masonry, I became Hiram Biff. And what I learned in the endowment, there's a series of degrees where, and I'll just say it kind of in a coy way, at the beginning of the endowment, we position ourselves in a very elemental base-like situation. At the end, there is a prayer. And if you think about the position of our bodies at that point, for me, Patrick, I become the instrument approaching God or pointing to God. And that is alchemical, going from a base to gold, or going from a rough ashlar to a smooth ashlar. So that's a very loaded way of saying it's, I guess I did say a lot without saying it, it's unsayable, but it is completely ineffable, and that has changed, completely transformed how I approach life, and my testimony and my religion has been strengthened, because there is a lot there to being wanting to know the esoteric side and having a mystical edge. Mormonism has that in leaps and bounds.
Awesome. Thank you, friend. Thanks for putting this together, too.
Thank you.
You did good with these guys.
Well, that's my biggest strength is I surround myself with people that make me look good, and I say that in all seriousness. So, people who are far smarter than I. So, anyway, take it away.
You're right there with everybody. Thanks, Lon. Will you go next, and then we'll go to Joe, and then we'll let Patrick guide us to George at the end if George will take the anchor spot.
So that sounds perfect. I think the one thing that occurs to me as we're talking today is that on the night I was initiated, there were probably two or three places in the entered apprentice degree where things hit me right between the eyes. And one of those is something that as Masons we refer to as the demand. And I won't go greatly into it, but I will say that we learn there the lesson of charity. And as we learn that lesson of charity, I remember standing in front of the dais in the east when the demand was being made of me, and at that moment having just this blinding flash of, I guess, inspiration, where I thought, you know, I spent years as a bishop and dealt with I don't know how many welfare cases and food orders and welfare checks, and I'd never heard it explained more beautifully than that. And it was enlightening. It was truly enlightening at that point. And without going into the actual wording, I'll just say that it's as far as their needs require and my abilities permit, without injuring myself or others as a result of it. And it just put into perfect balance and perspective for me that which the church is trying to teach when we talk about welfare and self-reliance and the balance between the two, taking care of our fellow man without becoming judgmental and still doing all that goes with it. So it just a tremendous experience for me, but one of the many enlightening sparks or flashes of brilliance that came across me as a result of going through those experiences. Again, it's made me a better Mormon. It's made me a better man. It's made me a better husband. I don't know how something that's done all of those things can be anything but good.
Thank you so much. Appreciate having you on, Lon.
Thank you.
Joe.
Freemasonry has influenced the way I view Mormonism. It's influenced the way I view the scripture formation process in Mormonism, what revelation is. And it's influenced the way I view the creation of ritual, such as the endowment. My own view is that the endowment is something old, something new, something borrowed, but it's all true.
Nice.
Right? Meaning that from a religious standpoint, the issue is not so much the precise origin of a ritual form, but rather whether a profane thing can become a holy token through which salvific grace flows to us. So Mormonism uses Freemasonry in very subtle ways, and urges us to consider how the commonplace becomes transformed into the sacred. It's a bit of spiritual alchemy. I want to kind of piggyback on what Patrick said. It's a bit of spiritual alchemy where the water of the commonplace is transformed into the holy wine of divine grace. And Latter-day Saints should be really aware of this more than others, that salvific power is never inherent in any object, not in a stone or a cane or a handkerchief, and certainly not in a set ritual form. It's always and ever in the priesthood which God gives to us for the transformation of ourselves and the transformation of the world.
And you'd go women priesthood there. You wouldn't.
Oh, yes. Yes, I would.
Okay.
Yes, I would.
Right. Not good, like as in you have to agree with me, but
No.
You mean something bigger than the typical day-to-day way it's used in Mormonism.
That is certainly the case. Yeah. It's transformed because, of course, this transforms society, right? It's meant to transform society. So we can talk about how commonplace things like water can be changed into wine. But the real bit of alchemy is how a common individual can be transformed into something uncommon. And Masonry has educated me on this. And then I can see it in Mormonism in a very powerful way. So,
awesome. Thank you, thank you. Appreciate having you. Boy, you've been really big ideas from you. Thanks so much, Joe.
I should mention at the close here, one of the reason I think like this is because I have been working on a book now for some time called Method Infinite on Mormonism and Freemasonry. It's Method Infinite, Freemasonry and the Mormon Restoration, and I'll be submitting my proposal for that here in the next couple of weeks. And
great.
Once it is published, I hope everybody here that's within the hearing of my voice will take an opportunity to kind of peruse that. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Sure. Thank you very much, Dan.
Oh, you bet. Enjoyed it very much. George, bring us home, brother. Patrick called you out. He says you're the one.
I hope that's the case. I'm not so sure it is. In the last few minutes, as hearing the other three guys talk, I've been trying to contemplate what it is that I want to say. One thing I do want to say, and I've mentioned this before, you know, as I look at this little lodge that we have here, we have Juan, Joe, Patrick. I mentioned before that I could look in the lodge and see those that were my mentors and those that I mentee. And I look at Joe, and he truly has been a mentor to me in much of this. And for that, I am thoroughly and completely appreciative and honored that he is my friend. I look at Patrick, and we are such friends. I love that. Joseph, yet again, one of those places he was riffing off his Masonic membership. He said, and I'm only paraphrasing here, that one of the grand fundamental principles of Mormonism is friendship. Now that phrase, as another friend of mine has noted, Joseph borrowed that from Freemasonry. That grand fundamental principles. One of the grand fundamental principles of Masonry is brotherhood. As we look at ourselves and we look out, we are the brother and the sisterhood of men. And we truly must treat each other as such. For if we don't, we will have missed one of the largest messages of Christianity, of really any religion, but more particularly of Mormons and of Masonry. One last comment I want to make is, as I came off of my mission, I always wanted to be able to be more mystical like Joseph. And to me, as I look at Joseph, someone who I do admire, though a man with, as with all of us, many faults, that Joseph managed to see in Masonry a mystical element and was able to transmute that into the religion of Mormonism. We've talked here often in several conversations of how sometimes we sit in a priesthood meeting or a church meeting, and we feel like our cell phones are more enticing than perhaps the talk. And I really wish that we would begin to look at that talk and what is being said, view it for its allegorical meaning, and transmute it into something that would change us.
Mm-hmm.
The last thing I'd like to say is quickly, it's been mentioned here several times that there are many books out there, most of them that have Mormons and Masons in their title, and how unsatisfactory and polemical they have been. Joe has been kind enough to share with me some of his chapter summaries, and from what I've seen so far, it will be definitive, and hopefully definitive, and will be really a game changer in the Mormon history field. And so I'd love to put a little plug in for his work there.
Plug, plug, plug. Good, Joe. Definitely alert us, and I'll try to, I'll certainly link to it from this, from the podcast, you know, website for this, but we'll try to help you other ways, get the word out. So, hey guys, thank you so much. I can't imagine four better representatives to talk about this. And I just, you know, there's the things that you said, and then there's the embodiment level that we might want to say of just you guys modeling what it's like to be true bilinguals, to inhabit two different worlds and two different languages and cultures and sensibilities, and just to see how those rub into such beautiful ways with each other. So, I mean, yeah, you've said brilliant things, but your hearts and your souls are just modeling what I hope to do with this little series of mine, of showing why it's important to love your Mormonism, but get informed. You know, you don't know your own language until you study another. Same thing. You don't know your own religion. You don't know your own rituals until you participate in others. And instead of the stance of fear that it will take away from our Mormon experience, you guys have modeled how it can only enhance. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You bet. And I have a feeling some people are going to ask some questions on the website, so I'll write to you guys or follow the discussion at mormonmatters.org. So listeners, please ask questions as needed, and if these guys don't respond to something specifically, I'll give them a little tweet and make sure that they notice that somebody's writing to them. But appreciate you doing that. While you're at the website, always please donate to Mormon Matters. It's so wonderful to get your subscriptions and donations when something strikes you as important in your life, and what you're able to do with your support lets me kind of be in this weird world of putting my life together without having to have a 9-to-5. I don't know. I'm not trying to denigrate a 9-to-5 job, but it is sort of a cobbling together, and your support is so essential for me to be able to at least do this piece of it. So thanks so much. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
And joy.